Okay, it's 1 o'clock, and welcome to the first real, I guess, broadcast. Although yesterday we did a test broadcast that was very real, and hopefully worked out some of the technical difficulties. But welcome. It's the 25th, Wednesday, the 25th of August, and broadcasting live from my apartment in Brooklyn, New York. The weather is lovely. What exactly the temperature is, I don't know. I haven't actually been outside yet today. But it's gorgeous, blue skies, and I guess I'll just start in, though yesterday I talked about some of these things, I'll just start with them again because today is the first official day of Radio Free America. I'm broadcasting from my apartment in Brooklyn. It's live from 1 to 3 every day. And this is my first project. With very little to no visuals, and this project came out of a frustration with visual media right now for me in terms of how to work with it in the current political global climate, and also feeling some sense of responsibility to start start working in sort of a larger way outside of my experience, I guess, or within my experience, but sort of talking about things outside of it as well. And this radio show is hopefully starting to do that with, even though it is still discussions with people within my community or directly linked to a smaller community of artists and friends and family, but it's starting to talk about things that are impacting our lives and also starting to make connections outside of our community, and of course broadcasting live on the internet, hoping to also communicate to people in other parts of the world and hopefully get feedback, responses, input, ideas, dialogue happening. So that said, I'm sitting in this lovely room that sort of a new room in our apartment that Mark built out when I was pregnant for, it was to be our child's room, and it's been sort of everything, including his room, in the year that he's been alive. But again, we were in here, our studio was in here, he was in here for a brief period of time, then everything went back out again, and we did some more work on it. And our friend Tom, and now it's empty and a fabulous room to be broadcasting out of. So it's kind of a dream. This period of time will definitely be sort of a dream in this room. Just me, my computer wires, a fantastic tablecloth that was sent to me from my friend Ulrika for my birthday, and some coffee. So, thanks for joining me today. We've got a bunch of things coming up after this brief introduction. There was some confusion about whether my grandmother is going to be available to talk to us about the news in a few minutes, so I'm just going to give a call and see if she is. If she's not, then she's not. And after that, we will talk to Mary Adams at her store on the Lower East Side. She walks from Chelsea to her store, her dress shop she's had for 20 years on the Lower East Side. And she's always got interesting things to relate about what she's seen and how that relates to sort of larger things that are happening or don't. And we'll just ask her what she's seen today, what she's thinking about. And then we'll also talk to Wade Nasanovich, who's a Brooklyn-based writer, about his commute as well. He commutes from Greenpoint, Brooklyn on his bicycle to the Garments District, his job at FIT, his day job at FIT every day. And then we'll be talking to Luther Blissett in Barcelona to get the weather and to hear about sort of what's growing in Barcelona, meaning both in the soil and in people's consciousness. After that, we'll be interviewing we. I love this we. It's like there's a tribe of people, not a tribe, but even somebody else besides me. My dog is sitting in the other room. I will be interviewing or talking to Mark Webson, the curator of the exhibition Watch What We Say, which this radio program is running in conjunction with. So we'll talk to him about his work. He's also a visual artist, so we'll talk to him about his work and his experience and process curating this exhibition. Then if there's time, we'll read a little bit more from the September essay by Aaron Dottie Roy, and we'll call it a day. So tonight is the Watch What We Say exhibition opening at Schroeder Romero in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. The address for the gallery is 173A North 3rd Street. It's just off of Bedford Avenue. Take that L train to Bedford Avenue and walk south and make a left on North 3rd, and it's about halfway up the block. It's the next door after the biggest laundromat you've ever seen in your life. So come celebrate from 6 to 9, the opening with us tonight. There's all sorts of great artists and work in the show. I was going to talk a little bit about what the baby and the dog did today. And it's been a relatively easy day with the baby today. He went out with Mark and the dog for a walk in the morning. So I don't have, that's my commute. There's always something amazing that happens when we walk the dog. So I don't have those stories to relay. And then the baby came back exhausted, so he took a nap. And he woke up angry, and we played some Tickle Coochie Coo. And he became happy, and I shuttled him downstairs to Grandma with some lunch. So thank you, Grandma, for watching Dove, Big Dove, so I can be doing my radio program. This couldn't be happening without you. Thank you to Diane and Nelson and Zinnia for helping me earlier with sound checks. And thank you to everybody who participated in yesterday's program. It was great. I was drunk with success and visions of opportunity after yesterday until I listened to the program, the archived footage of the program, and realized that the levels were all screwy. All right, so let's give California a call. My grandmother. And she spends a good portion of her day in front of the television watching CNN at very high volume. So I thought she'd be a good person to talk about what's going on in the mainstream news. She lives, I don't know if I already said this, she lives in the Central Coast of California. And I'm calling my folks right now because supposedly it's complicated. We'll see if she's there. Ah!
is in DeVries residence at 5434.
Nobody is there.
So, let's try her.
We'll try her also. I can't talk to her. We'll try her also at my aunt's, which is where she's living now. She's had some trouble staying vertical, so she needs to be in constant companionship.
Hello, you reached the Madison. You're on the phone right now.
Nobody's home, so we'll try her again in a little bit. So we'll give Mary a call and see how things are going at the store.
This is, again, Mary Adams. She has a dress shop on the Lower East Side that she's been in for 20 years.
Mary Adams' address.
Hi, Mary. It's Erica.
Hi, Erica.
You're on the radio.
I am.
You are. You am. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I had a revival. I got depressed this morning because I was so discouraged about the politics. On my way to work.
And did something specific happen, or?
I had to call my brother.
And that helps.
Yeah. He said he was depressed yesterday, but he had a revival today.
So, so his revival revived you.
Yes.
And well, did something specific happen in terms of politics that made you more, or was it just you started thinking about them again?
Well, I woke up and listened to NPR, and they interviewed some people in Ohio that was a swing state.
Uh-huh.
That is a swing state. And just sometimes when I hear people's comments, like, you know, who they're going to vote for and why, and when they ask, you know, this one guy, he was like, yeah, I vote for George Bush because he caught Saddam Hussein. Like, things like that I find really extremely depressing.
Yes.
And then this other lady said, I was going to vote for Kerry, but now I'm not sure because of the Swift vote revelation.
And oh, right.
I just thought, wow, how can people be so gullible by the media, you know, just manipulating the media? People are just, you know, they don't get the truth, and it's really depressing.
Yeah.
So anyway, and then on my way to work, what happened? Nothing was going on at Union Square. Usually there's something there. But there was one store on 4th Avenue that had their whole entire windows covered with "Meet here to bash Bush on September, blah, blah." And so that was sort of encouraging.
I think that's fun.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? There's going to be a party there, or...
They might, you know, I've heard on the radio today that there's, all kinds of organizations that are marching and they're meeting at different places. Have you heard any of this? Besides the main ones.
No, I haven't. I mean, I've heard of different kinds of, like, fundraisers and things. Is that the same thing, or?
No, I think there's specific marches and stuff.
Uh-huh.
Different people are meeting different places. Different groups are meeting different places. And so maybe that place, that particular store, was a place where you could meet to either funnel into one of the other marches or something like that.
Right.
What else did they say about the marches? Oh, yeah, like there's one group of people that are staging this, like, yell, this big communal yell.
Uh-huh.
That you're supposed to go stand on the corner, any corner, at 11 o'clock and all yell, you hate Bush or something.
Oh my goodness.
And I thought that would be really funny if everybody actually did that, that there would just be this huge collective howl.
Yeah.
In New York. That would be really cool, I think.
It'd be
kind of
terrifying.
Like, huh?
Kind of terrifying.
Not if you knew what it was.
Yeah, I know. Well, just like it's so primal.
I know. Yeah, It would be really amazing if everybody did that. It would be like what happens on New Year's Eve, you know? When you open your window and you hear everybody screaming and hollering and all at once and stuff, it's kind of cool because it's a collective movement.
And where are you, where are you hearing about these things?
Well, I heard about them on, I think it was the Leonard Lopez show.
Uh-huh.
They were talking about a lot of different marches. I can't remember exactly which. It just sounded like there was, like, amazing amount of different things happening that were different groups organizing, and they had gotten permits to march or to assemble in different areas and stuff. So it sounded like the whole city was just going to be this different groups and different places having their own little protests.
On different days.
I guess. Yeah. I can't quite get a grip on it. I can't tell. I mean, it seems like, well, it's summer, so half the people in New York are gone already, and it seems amazing to me that people are actually going to be coming in to demonstrate. And then, so I can't really tell who's going to be here. I mean, or how many people are going to be here. They're making it sound like, you know, there's just going to be 250,000 people just on that one march alone. And then there's other marches. So what do you think?
What do you mean about which part of it? Like how many people there will be?
Yeah, like how many people do you think? Have you heard a lot of people coming into town or busloads?
I guess there are a few people that I'm hearing about specifically that are coming. I mean, it's more like my friend's sister or that sort of thing. Not people.
And where's she coming from?
There's people coming from California that I know of.
Really? Specifically to protest?
Yeah. and then there was an article in The Guardian today that my friend Lori forwarded to me that I did not read in entirety, but it was about people coming to New York from England even to protest.
Really?
Yeah. So
that's inspiring. Maybe I'll be in a really good mood by then.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think, like if you focus on our microcosm of New York, it's really inspiring, I feel, because I feel like every day I'm getting emails about exhibitions that are opening or fundraisers and, like, all sorts of things, like, get Bush out of office and, like, you know, with various agendas from, like, revolution to just, like, vote Kerry. But I think it's incredibly electric right now and exciting in the city. But you know, when you say you hear, like, interviews outside of the city or, you know.
I know. It just makes me scared because I just can't, you know, the general public isn't getting the real news. And they're so swayed by the news they get. And it's like, you know, propaganda news practically. And that Swift Boat thing is a perfect example of that. The damage is already done no matter what Bush says next. You know, like, oh, yeah, that's terrible. I'm sorry.
Right.
You know, the damage is already done. These people already think that that's true.
Right.
And they're already changing their minds about voting. Like, that kind of stuff is really scary, I think. I find it frightening that, you know, you could just go on and just make up a big old fat lie.
It's bizarre. I mean, part of it is, like, totally interesting and exciting and, like, in, like, sort of a fiction kind of way. And then it's terrifying also, like you said.
Yeah.
You know, like, this idea of, like, that fiction can...
Well, it's propaganda is what it is, and you see how it can work in its most evil ways and influence people that are, you know, not going out of their way to read different material, different literature that's out there, different newspapers, European newspapers, and they're getting a really limited and false sense of what's going on and what is actually happening.
Yeah.
And I think that's really a frightening part of our world right now. So, anyway. I might have to get to work now.
Okay.
My worker bee is here.
Your worker bee. Well, say hello to Shavid, the worker bee.
Okay. And I did talk to my brother, and I'll call you, or you can call me later, and he'll be glad to speak with you tomorrow morning.
Okay, great. Mary's brother was one of the finalists in the Move On. Can you say it more specifically than I can?
No, only because I don't know what they called their original video competition.
Right, it was like a 30-second, like...
Bash Bush,
exactly. Yeah, the first spot that they kind of asked amateur people, or not amateur, they just put out an open call for people to respond, and he was one of the finalists. So that's great, that's exciting.
Yeah. So, anyway, thanks for calling.
Okay, thanks for talking to me, Mary, and I'll talk to you tomorrow.
All right.
Okay, bye.
All right, so that was Mary from the Lower East Side, and next we're going to check in with Wade at FIT at his day job. Wade, again, is a Brooklyn-based writer of fiction. And we'll ask him, he was having a few things published lately. We'll ask him where they're published, but he has a day job at the...
financial aid office in...
You know, actually, I'm going to leave the phone off for a few minutes in case anybody who's listening wants to call and make any comments on what Mary had to say, because I actually told Wade... I call him closer to 1:30, so it'd be great if anyone has comments in relation to what Mary was talking about, 718-692-4571. And I'll pull up that Guardian article and see what it was saying. So this is from today's Guardian, courtesy of Lori Novak, and it says, the protesters are coming. It seems like the perfect location for next week's Republican convention, but with widespread anti-war feeling, hordes of protesters descending on the city, and alleged FBI intimidation fueling the fear of violence, New York is preparing a noisy reception for President Bush. Gary Young reports. 6 weeks after the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center, President George Bush flew to New York to throw out the ceremonial first pitch in the World Series baseball game after the Yankees and the Arizona, between the Yankees and the Arizona Diamondbacks. The president was finding it difficult to throw the ball in his bulletproof vest. Are you going to throw from the rubber of the base or the mound? Asked Yankee star Derek Jeter. The rubber, the highest point on the mound, is the point from which a pitcher would usually throw. Bush had been planning to throw from the base, which is about 6 to 10 feet closer to the home plate. If you throw from the base of the mound, they are going to boo you. You really need to take the rubber, said Jeter. Bush, then at the height of his popularity and leading a nation at war with Afghanistan in fear of an anthrax attack, asked Jeter if the fans would really be so mean. Yeah, said Jeter, it's New York. 3 years later, Bush is coming back to New York to a skeptical, if not downright hostile public as the Republicans prepare to kick off their convention on Monday. In an ad broadcast in June to prepare New Yorkers, former Democratic Mayor Ed Koch pleaded, while they are here, make nice. Volunteer to show them the ropes. They won't know uptown from downtown. They've never ordered pizza by the slice. But with a week to go, the best they can hope for is that the city, where registered Democrats outnumber Republicans by 5-1, doesn't, quote-unquote, make too nasty. It may be in vain. So numerous are the expected protesters at the presence of the grand old party in the city that its Republican mayor, Michael Bloomberg, has spoken of them. has spoken of them as a marketing opportunity. Last week, he offered discounts to Broadway shows, museums, stores, and restaurants to those wearing buttons bearing a picture of the Statue of Liberty and the words peaceful political activists. It's no fun to protest on an empty stomach, so you might want to try a restaurant, said Bloomberg, or you might want to go shopping, maybe for another pair of sneakers for the march. My goodness, I hadn't heard all of this. Okay. I had heard, but I hadn't heard the specifics. The protesters, meanwhile, are making their own plans at www.rncnotwelcome.org, a website dedicated to protesting against the convention. A group called the Biotech Baking Brigade spells out the basics of how to pie your enemy. Step one, choose a worthy target. Any evil, pompous evildoers will do for glooping. After that, it breaks down the strategy to bite-sized chunks, including plan your pan. And the meringue is the message. A group of activists plan to ride down Lexington Avenue on bicycles, shouting, "The Republicans are coming, the Republicans are coming," mimicking the 18th century Massachusetts craftsman Paul Revere, who rode a horse through the state warning locals that the British were coming during the American War of Independence. A group of bell ringers, meanwhile, are planning to surround the site of Ground Zero, ringing 2,749 bells to commemorate the victims of September 11th and oppose the war. Visitors to the city at the end of August may see illegal murals with political messages, and the city itself may become a giant art installation, warns Liza Featherstone in the left-wing Nation magazine. Don't be surprised if you're crossing the street and a traffic light flashes, beat bush instead of don't walk. But not all the demonstrations will be unorthodox attention grabbers. Among the more traditional acts of protest will be a parade of thousands of abortion rights advocates marching across the Brooklyn Bridge. That's this Saturday, by the way. The hip-hop summits, Poor People's March to Madison Square Garden, where the convention is being held. The 5,000-strong permitless march of the poor being organized by a welfare mother from Philadelphia, and the huge demonstration planned for Sunday, which the demonstrators insist will be in Central Park, and the New York police are adamant will be on the West Side Highway, but which could reach a million strong. Reverend Earl Cooper Camp of St. Mary's Episcopal Church in Harlem will be hosting between 30 and 50 protesters on the wooden pew of his church, and has persuaded more than 30 other religious institutions to do the same, offering housing to almost 500 people. As long as they're standing firm against war, working for peace, that's what the church is supposed to be about, he told the New York Times. We pray every day to a guy called the Prince of Peace. Peace may not be on everyone's mind, however. At least 20,000 security personnel representing everyone from the Secret Service to civilian units of the Army National Guard have been mustered. Given that the convention is expected to attract only 48,000 visitors, including delegates, lobbyists, and journalists, this is the equivalent to one law enforcement official for every 2.1 civilians. Meanwhile, the Federal Bureau of Investigation has been questioning dozens of protesters who plan to come to New York, asking them all three basic questions. Were they planning to be violent? Did they know anyone else who was planning violent acts? And did they understand that it is a crime to withhold any information if they might know? The questioning immediately raised concerns about civil liberties, particularly after three young men who were planning to come to New York from Missouri were subpoenaed earlier this month and informed that they were part of a domestic terrorism investigation without being informed on what grounds. It is part of a national effort to chill dissent in this country, said Bill Dobbs, the spokesman for United for Peace and Justice, which is staging week-long demonstrations in New York during the convention. And it is always a worry that this kind of intimidation will scare people off. The FBI isn't in the business of chilling anyone's First Amendment rights, said Joe Paris, an FBI spokesman, referring to the right of free speech and free assembly enshrined in the United States Constitution. But criminal behavior isn't covered by the First Amendment. The fact that the focus has shifted from what will be said inside the convention to what might happen outside is a symbol of just how much has changed in the national political mood over the past 18 months. Back in January 2003, when the party declared its choice of New York over New Orleans and Tampa, it seemed like a shrewd, if cynical, move. The logic behind both the venue and the timing, the latest of any convention, was to bolster George Bush's status as a war leader, standing firm against terrorist attacks. What we focused on was that New York was the best background for the convention growing out of the events of September 11th, says Roland Betts, a member of the Committee of Republicans assembled by Bloomberg to lobby the White House to come to New York. As recently as July last year, former Mayor Rudolph Giuliani was claiming that Bush could even be the first Republican to take the state since Ronald Reagan in 1984. New Yorkers like strong leaders, he explained at the time. But that was then. In January 2003, when the announcement was made, the nation was facing down the United Nations, preparing for war with Iraq. President Bush had a 59% approval rating, 68% of Americans supported military force against Saddam Hussein, and the Democrats were amassing a crowded field of contenders with no obvious frontrunner. Today, Bush's approval ratings stand at 49%. 47% of Americans think going to war was a mistake, and his Democratic challenger, John Kerry, leads in 13 of the 17 key swing states, if only by a narrow margin in most of them, with the latest poll giving Bush 35% in New York against Kerry's 53%. He has about as much chance of taking New York as Saddam Hussein does of taking back Baghdad. Opposition to the war was not insignificant at the time, but it had been marginalized. But the torture scandal in Abu Ghraib, President Bush's premature declaration of victory in Iraq, a stiffer-than-expected Iraqi resistance, a lack of international support, and U.S. military casualties that could reach 1,000 during the convention have put the war into mainstream political debate. Meanwhile, the findings of the 9/11 Commission into the terrorist attacks, the publication of which has become a bestseller, have exposed institutional shortcomings that put a question mark even over what he hoped would be seen as his finest hour. In May last year, the leaseholder of the World Trade Center, Larry Silverstein, told the Daily News that New York State's Republican government, Governor George Pataki, wanted to lay the cornerstone to the new building during this year's convention. With the political winds blowing against them, he did it on July 4th instead. If you were to do something overtly political around Ground Zero, you'd get hammered for it, and rightly so, says Michael McKeon, a Republican strategist and former senator aide to Pataki. Sitting in a field last week just outside Orange, Connecticut, about 20 mostly young people were discussing nonviolence. They were about two-thirds of the way through a 258-mile march from Boston, scene of the Democratic Convention, to New York, where they planned to protest. 6 miles and several hours earlier, they had set off from New Haven, Connecticut, crossing paths with the Stonewalk, a procession of family members of 9/11 victims, pulling a 1,400-pound granite memorial honoring the unknown civilians killed in war, also heading for the Republican Convention. About two-thirds of the 50 or so in the march would describe themselves as anarchists, although there are Buddhists, pacifists, and others for whom, knowing that they could not bear another 4 years of Bush is enough. I don't have a problem with people telling the police to go fuck themselves, said one, prompting a debate over the issue of verbal as opposed to physical violence. Also under discussion is the issue of whether to go limp or unarrest people if the police try to take them away. None of these people have walked all this way to, quote-unquote, make nice. But this particular band of vegan, non-hierarchical political travelers are not out to carve great chunks out of the Big Apple either. Like the authorities, however, they feel the need to be prepared if things do spiral out of control. With no venue so far agreed for the main demonstration on Sunday, the tempers rising over the FBI's tough stance, there's plenty of scope for tensions to flare into something more serious. The last time the issue of violence dominated a national political convention was Chicago, 1968. Back then, there was a war in a far-off land, a divisive Republican candidate in Richard Nixon, and a mayor who pledged not to compromise. The police responded to verbal abuse from protesters and occasional missiles with tear gas and occasional beatings. Connecticut Senator Abraham Ribicoff took to the podium to decry Gestapo tactics in the streets of Chicago. It was a public relations disaster for the Democrats, and Nixon went on a few months later to defeat Hubert Humphrey. With Kerry taking a moderate stance on the war, these demonstrations have little, if anything, to do with the Democratic Party. Nonetheless, many believe that whoever is responsible, a rash of violence so close to the election will once again benefit the Republicans. If I were a voice in top Republican circles, I might be offering this advice. What we need for New York is a large-scale riot, wrote Norman Mailer in the New York Magazine recently. In a public written exchange with his son, I don't have a great deal of hope that most of the people involved are really thinking of this election so much as expressing the need to vent, to gain some self-therapy. You do get a sense of the spiritual revolution may be awakening, replied his son, John Mailer, who believes that the protests could provide a focus for a huge anti-corporate movement. All right, replied Norman, but if we lose the election, it's going to be a very expensive spiritual education. So that was in today's Guardian paper, www.guardian.co.uk. Care of Lori Novak. Thanks, Lori, for sending that on. So we'll try checking in with Wade on his commute to FIT today. See Wade.
Hey, Wade, it's Erica.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm fine.
Okay. Where
How are you?
I'm okay. A little stuffed up.
A little what?
A little congested.
Congested? That, physically or, in your,
emotionally?
Control center. Oh, emotionally.
No, no,
You're congested emotionally.
Yeah, I was finishing your sentence. No, and my head got a cold, and I'm sitting in a room that has lots of drywall dust, so.
Oh, there, you home?
I'm home.
You're home?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right, you would have drywall dust.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah, but other than that, I'm good. I've come down from yesterday's high, and I'm kind of back to reality a little
bit. So you're not as, feverish with enthusiasm, I could tell that yesterday.
I know, yesterday was like so, I mean, I had a lot of caffeine, but like just that everything was working and connecting and happening, like I was drunk. Yeah.
Yeah, it reminds me when I was a kid and I would have my bicycle, I was always fixing it and it would never operate correctly. And then when it did, I was so happy that it was actually running. And then I would really be really sad when something broke on it because for some reason, I don't know what it was. It was never part of my plan to actually buy parts or anything. You know, if you couldn't fix it with like a wrench and a screwdriver and some wire and tape or something, then you wouldn't fix your bike.
Right.
And so I always had that feeling when I had a bike that was up and running. It made me very happy, you know, but also there's that specter of malfunction that's really common.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I guess my equivalent was then last night when I was overtired, I listened to the archive footage and that the levels were all wonky, and so then I kind of got really, like, pulled back in, ripped back into reality that there was still work to be done and it wasn't as beautiful and perfect as, and so maybe the equivalent would be like getting on your bike and like the chain falls off after you've just thought you fixed it perfect.
Maybe we should just keep on indulging this bicycle metaphor the entire interview.
Well, speaking of bicycles,
does it sound like you're speaking underwater or something? Via the archive?
No, just like my interview with Carla yesterday, one of the artists in the exhibition, like the levels were really crap on her end, and so you can't hear any of it. So I just have to pull it through like some program. It just means that yesterday, whoever was listening to her interview, and there were people listening, which is exciting, didn't hear much because she was really low.
But the archive will be better.
The archive will be better, and I'll put it online. And it just, it's, you know, a little disappointing because it was really great. Like, it was really great to hear her talk about her piece in the show and her process of making it, and she was installing it, and so it was kind of nice. So it'll be on the website eventually.
Oh, listen. I think Amy Bay is out there listening right now.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Amy Bay.
Hi, Amy.
Hi, Leo Bay. Baby Leo Bay.
I know. Hello, Leo.
So you hear your father? So, back to bicycles.
What was that?
Back to bicycles. Did you ride yours today?
Yeah, I really, you know, yesterday riding home, sometimes I'm tired after work and I don't really feel like riding home, but then once I start going, I don't know if I'm happy, but I just kind of get into the ride and I forget about not really wanting to ride home. And then, you know, you wake up the next morning and you're very energetic, and then I feel like, oh, I'm going to ride my bike again. So I hope I don't feel that way tonight when I go home. But anyway, as for the ride, I took my typical ride. So I over the Williamsburg Bridge. And
you went over the Williamsburg Bridge?
Uh-huh. And then I went up First Avenue. So I go up Delancey to Allen Street, First Avenue, and then can't cross on 27th because there's some kind of plaza there or something. So actually, I rode a long time on a one-way street, which I don't normally do. I don't like, you know, putting myself in that kind of peril. People do it all the time.
Going the wrong way on the one-way street or just... Right.
Yeah, there are always people riding the wrong way on the one-way street. That's
right.
Why whenever you cross the street as a pedestrian and you're jaywalking, you should always look both ways. You never know when the cyclist is going to speed by.
Right.
So that's my piece of advice for today. So, because I wanted to stop at a cafe, and I couldn't really figure out how to access it anyway, so I went up 26th Street. Otherwise, I would have, you know, it's not like a car, where I'm in a bicycle, I'm not going to, like, go all the way up to another block that goes the right way and then circle back around or something. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, yesterday you rode how many tens of blocks further south to go over a different bridge and then tens of blocks back north.
Yeah, this was not like that. This was a very efficient route.
Right.
Probably when, I mean, it's kind of disappointing because, you know, once you ride it a certain amount of times, you kind of get your most efficient route. And then, you know, invariably you're running late, so you do the most efficient route. But the problem with the most, the problem is you don't really see any new stuff. But you always see new people, obviously, because you never see the same person twice. But, so it's a good route. And it's also really good, too, because I can almost, once I cross Houston Street, I can almost hit every light all the way up to 25th, where I usually go over. So that made it very fast. But I also don't like First Avenue so much. So anyway, so that was my route. And then I had a coffee and a cigarette, and that was really good. And then I went to work.
Do you smoke while you ride your bike?
No, but, you know, I don't do that, but that's the one thing I do like.
Wait, are you talking into your mouthpiece? You keep, like sounding further and then closer.
Oh, maybe it's every time it goes like this?
Do that. Talking.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, it's much better.
I'm sorry. I have to. You know, the problem is, it's the cell phone, it's hard to. I don't know. Well, I should just get a hand-free set and do this.
I know. I should give you one.
Can you hear me?
Free, Eric. I can hear you great now. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, what were we just talking about? No, I don't smoke while I ride, but a lot of people in New York do.
I know.
Which is great. I think that is the greatest thing. It's like the last bastion of smoking while riding a bicycle.
Oh, it seems like I'd be afraid I'd like swallow the cigarette or something.
I think it's actually a whole aesthetic. I think probably if you survey them, at least 70% would rather stop and smoke a cigarette, but it's part of that messenger code or something where you smoke a cigarette now and then on the bike because you're always on the move.
Wait, now you're far away again.
Are you serious?
Yeah, there, now better.
Okay. I really don't know.
It's the messenger.
Was it like this yesterday at all?
Probably, but I know.
Now you're like striving for a perfection.
That's right.
You don't want to have to run me through some software.
I don't have to run you through any software. okay, so you gave me the technicalities of your commute, but like, give me some of the aesthetics, like, or things in relation to the convention that you saw or didn't see or.
Oh, I didn't do that yet. I should do that. I should go over the 59th Street Bridge, and I haven't. No, there's nothing. I have nothing. I have no news to report, at least from the perspective of my bicycle regarding the Republican National Convention.
Okay.
But aesthetically, aesthetics. Oh. You know, hey, was that on the question list? I don't know if you
sure.
put that on the question list. You know, the thing is, part of the problem with riding the bike is that you're always, paying attention
to your bike,
so you don't get hit, or you don't like sometimes I'm not paying attention, you'll hit a really big hole, and like sometimes the holes are really big, like they're deep. It's not like something the bottom of your wheel would touch. Your wheel would just go in and then hit the rim of the hole. It's so deep. I'm always afraid of being thrown from my bike, so I don't really see that much. I don't think I pay attention so much. You know what happened, though? Maybe if you hypnotize me. Hello?
Yes.
Oh, okay, so there. Maybe if you hypnotize me, you would get some kind of you get a whole, like unconscious rainbow of experiences. But a lot of times I'm just kind of riding on the road. Sometimes, actually, it's weird. It's something I do, and I don't know why. But a lot of times I look down and I look at my legs.
Uh-huh.
Maybe that's why I'm hitting the holes.
I don't know.
By the way, I want to mention something. You know, I go to this guy to get my watch fixed, and I'm out here because I came over here to, he has two cats that come out, and I always pet his cat. He's a really great cat. And so I looked, and I found out he had this laminated Cindy Adams column in his window. And so if you see a Cindy Adams column in the window, you think it must be something important, you know, related to the store. And he is making Britney Spears customized boots, this guy who fixed my watch.
Oh, yeah?
Isn't that exciting?
He makes boots as well as fixes watches?
He does everything. He used to be, I'm not sure the whole deal, but he used to be in, like, Russian army, and he's, it was kind of a broken conversation, I forget a lot of it, but one of the things he said, I'm not sure if he's Chechen or if he's just from, like, southern Russia or those, you know, those, like, states that, don't want to be a part of, or didn't want to be a part of the Soviet Union. And he was telling me, he was like, since he was, like dark hair, he was able to, like dark complexion, he was discriminated against when he was in, like, St. Petersburg, which I thought was interesting.
Uh-huh.
He was, like, considered, like, black or something, like, for Russians. But, so, yeah, he's a guy. I mean, I think he's a little bit too much of a jack-of-all-trades. Like, he's spreading his skills a little bit too thinly because, and I hope he's better at doing customized boots than he is at fixing my watch.
Well, he's doing celebrity
boots. I mean, he fixes a watch, but, like, it winds and then it will, like kind of spins the movie wind. It's one of these watches that used to wind. Actually, it was a gift from Amy, who's listening. I hope she's listening. It's your watch I'm talking about. And I insist on always getting it fixed because, really, it was one of the first gifts we don't really give each other gifts. She gave me this gift, and it was really nice.
I remember that. You guys came over for dinner, like, the next day or something.
Oh, really? And I was wearing the watch?
You were talking about it. You were probably wearing it, too, but...
Uh-huh. So I don't know what happened to the watch, but, like, when you wind it, sometimes... It's like, you can feel, like, I guess there's, like, a gear in there, that little, like, peg that's connected to the little round knob that you wind. You know, sometimes it's slipping. It's not catching. The gear's not catching. So... Of course, I bring it back. I say, hey, it's not working. And then he just, like, puts in his hand and starts winding it, and it starts winding.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, it works. And then what I realize is that it's just trial and error. You have to keep on winding it until it catches. And then it will catch, and you wind it up. And then hopefully it will keep on catching. And then sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, it's kind of a watch, really, that you have to set every day. I don't know why I'm really just ragging on Amy's gift. I'm not ragging on it. I love the watch. I love the aesthetic. I have very, like, fine, feminine wrists. And it looks great on them. You only wear my watch on the left wrist. I enjoy really wearing a short sleeve shirt to work and wearing the watch. But then also, if I ride my bike, it gets sweaty and it really smells. And then it soaks into the leather.
Of the watch?
And the leather carries that kind of stench.
Uh-huh. And then every time your wrist goes by your nose, you're like, what's that?
I can't hear you at all. There's a stiff breeze blowing through.
I hear you.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay, I can hear you.
All right.
Hello?
Yes.
This call, like, officially is exactly the way calling Romania was in the 70s.
do you have vivid memories of calling Romania in the 70s?
Yeah, that's when I was trafficking in contraband.
Right, okay. Well, all right, thanks for your commute today, Wade.
Oh, thanks a lot, and I hope it was pedestrian enough for you.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I dragged Britney Spears into the pedestrian fray.
Oh, no, it's great. And, I mean, of course, he's paying less attention to your watch because he's, you know, like, where would your attentions be?
That is true.
Britney Bootmaker or a Wade watch success.
Well, you know, that's what happens with these artisans. They lose touch once they get in contact with celebrity.
Right, with the people. Right, well, we're a radio station for the people.
Exactly. I hope to have more Republican National Convention coverage. All I can say is that there are all kinds of people commuting into Penn Station who... they're freaking out because they're afraid they're not going to be able to get out of the compound.
Yeah.
So, but there's all kinds of instructions that are supposed to aid them.
Well, don't put yourself at physical, don't start paying attention to aesthetics on your ride and forget about safety.
I know. I wish I could. I have to start thinking about that. I can't really
think about it when you're not on your bike.
My walks, it's much better. You see more things, and you know, but you kind of see the same people, and I'll see. Maybe I'll, I don't know. I'm gonna just continue on my way. You know, I have a kid now, Erica. I can't put myself at risk for aesthetics.
No, absolutely. All right.
Okay, you know what?
What?
Just checking, because I am scheduled in the afternoon one of these days. So, can I make this call earlier? Can you call me earlier on another day?
Yeah, you'll tell me which day, or you want to tell me now?
I'm going to email you, and I'll tell you when you can call me on what days, and then you can just confirm and let me know.
Okay, great.
All right. Hey, by the way, who else are you calling today?
Well, I tried my grandmother, but she wasn't home.
Uh-huh.
At two places. I talked to Mary Adams. You met Mary, right? The dressmaker? She has a shop on the Lower East Side. She's also doing, she's also doing observations. And you, and then I'm talking to Luther Blissett in Barcelona next. And then I'm
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, I want to listen to that.
Well,
what is that?
It's next. As soon as I hang up from you.
I guess I'll catch it on the archive.
Yeah, he's living in Barcelona, so he's going to give us the weather and what's growing, that stuff. And
you know what the weather is in Barcelona?
I don't know what it is.
Sunny.
Oh, it's
sunny.
Okay.
That's what the weather is. The weather map in Barcelona, if you're a weatherman in Spain,
uh-huh.
You have rain, clouds, sunny. That's it. They don't do weather in Barcelona.
Mm-hmm.
That's just great. There's no such thing as Doppler radar unless you work for the government. All right, I know you have to go. I'm sorry. I'm doing the same thing I did to you yesterday. So listen, talk about tapas and, like, anchovies and like, and weird fish that no one would, like, ever be caught eating here stateside.
Okay.
All right,
I'll do that. And I have, I talked to Martin yesterday.
He
didn't know about the mulch question trying to stop weeds or
Knock
them back. But then a friend called from California who does landscaping, and he said that, yes, a couple inches of mulch, or he said monkey grass, like stuff to block the light, basically, it sounds like. Don't grow in that area.
Uh-huh.
And he said that's going to work great.
Huh, that's great. Well, wow, this is...
News
and we're
research.
Really starting a pragmatic network.
We are. We have to stay home and, research.
Are you going to call those guys again, Martin and Olga?
I am going to call them at the weekend.
So you're applying for the grant so you can pay for it?
Yeah, right.
And then the grant money?
Next time around. But at the weekend, so maybe you guys could come by the gallery, because I'll be at the gallery on Sunday broadcasting. You could come by and talk to them if you want.
Oh, wow, that would be cool.
All right, well, we'll talk more tonight at the opening.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah. Bye.
All right, bye, Wade. Thanks so much. So now we're calling Luther in Barcelona. And hopefully I've got his number written down here correctly, typed in correctly. Let's try it again. Lovely. Just take a minute to make a connection.
Hola.
Luther.
Hello.
Mr. Blissett. How you doing?
Very good.
How's Barcelona?
Nice.
What time is it there?
It's around 7:30, almost 8.
Is it still light out?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's still light out. It's cloudy, though.
Uh-huh. What's the approximate temperature?
The approximate temperature, in the 20s Celsius.
Uh-huh.
Which, I don't remember what that would make it, Fahrenheit. 60s? I don't know, something like that. Could that be?
20, I remember we used to get off for school when I was a kid in Germany at 25, and that was like 75, so probably, yeah, 60s. I don't know. That's
no, 25.
No, 20, like you said. Yeah, we used to get off. Hit the Fry is what it was called. You get... It was too hot in Germany. I mean, believe me, it didn't happen very often, so... Anyway.
So maybe it's around... It's a less than 25 degrees.
Yeah, 20, yeah.
Maybe.
Okay.
Degrees. I'm outside, so...
Where are you?
I'm in, Minas de Viviendas, which is a squatted building, 10 stories high, where 30 people live,
mm-hmm.
and where I live, by the sewing studio next to the garden. That's where I am.
Uh-huh. And what's happening in the garden?
Okay, calling it a garden might be an exaggeration. It's, right now, so it's five wooden drawers that we found in one of the apartments, filled with soil, with various vegetables and herbs sprouting out of it, zucchinis and cucumbers and basil and stuff like that. That's the garden, really, so far.
Uh-huh, sounds good. And so what's in season? Everything that you just listed?
I hope so, because I just planted it. I hope it's in season.
Oh, you just planted it. So do you have any zucchinis yet?
I haven't eaten anything
yet. That would be
yet.
A smoke alarm. Sorry.
What is that?
The smoke alarm's going off in my apartment.
Are you burning something?
I hope not. Okay, I'm sorry. So, back to the zucchinis.
Yeah, I haven't eaten any zucchinis yet. But I think it's all in season, because Barcelona really never gets so cold, so I think it's not a big deal.
Right. I don't know, like tomatoes, like they're happening right now in New York. Like, this is the window of opportunity for tomatoes. And it's closed.
Do you have tomatoes?
We do, we have tomatoes. We have cherry tomatoes and big tomatoes. And they're so good.
Yeah, we have tomatoes too.
Yeah, good. So
tomatoes across the world.
So tell me more about the place where you live. Like,
okay, so it's a building 10 stories high in the center of Barcelona. That used to be it was abandoned for maybe 16 years. Well, it wasn't completely abandoned. It was in the process of being abandoned. There were some neighbors living here, and the owner, who was sort of this, let's say he was a very mean guy, and he was, this was low-income housing, so he was trying to kick everyone out so he can turn it into high-income housing. So he just, he tried to declare it in ruins. He said that it's structurally unsound, and he had this legal process with the neighbors for 16 years, and slowly, like, more and more of them left, and whenever someone would leave, he would send goons over to break the windows, and all these pigeons came in, and then we came in. And there were some neighbors here, and but they were in the process of leaving. And the building was bought by a big real estate company that owns, like, one of the biggest real estate companies in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And now they've filed a complaint against us, and they're trying to kick us out.
Uh-huh.
But in the meantime, we live here around 30 people, and we have a sewing studio and a vegetable garden, and we do on a hack lab with a computer. people doing strange computer stuff. And what else do we have? I don't know. And we just live there for free. And it's close to the beach. And we go to the beach. And we act like we're retired. I don't know.
That sounds great. And so what does that mean, like, in Spanish, like, law system? Like, do you guys have any idea how long you'll be able to be there, or is it something you can...
Yeah, actually, it could be a matter of days.
Oh.
Because we've had an eviction order, and then it was suspended. We're in this, like, whole thing. It's kind of an unknown, because it really depends on, like, the very specific situation, and every house is different. So, for us, like, they want to kick us out, so they can, their plan is, I think, to close up the building and just not do anything with it until the value goes up.
Uh-huh.
We actually saw that on their website, that they're not really even going to do anything with this building.
It's depressing.
Yeah, it's annoying, but it doesn't matter, because we've been here for 6 months, and it's been fun.
Good.
Hopefully we'll be able to stay longer.
Yeah. How much of your psychic energy does that take up, the unpleasant part?
Yeah, almost all of it.
Oh.
Because there's always... Because first of all, the building was in really bad shape, so it took us 3 months to just make it livable in terms of hooking it up to electricity, hooking up the water, cleaning it. It was full of pigeons, and you can just imagine how disgusting that was.
Yeah.
So we cleaned it almost all up, and I mean it was a mess, this building, and then. You know, rehabbing a kitchen and then just like daily life is really actually takes a lot of time just upkeeping it, even because it's a huge building and, you know, we kind of want to keep it nice. So just regular house can even, you know, so that takes a lot of energy. But we're trying to each actually have our own lives too, not to be like just in service of the building. So,
right.
So we all—I mean, everyone has their own projects and their own things going on, and then we also have projects that we do together. And yeah, it takes a lot of energy, but it's something that beats working.
Yeah, it sounds
for
good.
For someone that I don't like.
Right. Don't work for yourself.
Yeah.
So tell me about some of your projects, or your collaborative projects, or the projects that you're working on, or
I'm specifically doing a lot of sort of sewing, fashion design kind of stuff. Trying to work on collaborative fashion projects, sort of applying a different attitude towards intellectual property and authorship to fashion design, that kind of thing. Basically, that means that we have a sewing studio, and whatever we make, we make patterns of, and the patterns are just there for anyone to use, so people can just change them and make their own stuff, and then, you know, so that people teach each other, and we do these workshops and, you know, fashion shows, and we make clothes for direct action that we do, and for other stuff. We're also part of this project called Yo Mango. You know this, you don't know this.
I think I do from you. I think you sent me... Talk about it, though.
Okay. Yomango is basically a... Okay, Mango is a clothing chain in that comes to stay in, like a multinational clothing chain.
Right.
And manga is Spanish, means sleeve. And mangar means to sleep, basically to shoplift. And yo mango means I steal. And it's basically a project that has to do with it's sort of a multinational corporation that sells you doesn't sell you anything. It's it deals okay. Let me trace back. Like all multinational corporations, we're not really involved in selling a product. More than that, we're trying to promote a lifestyle.
Right.
And the lifestyle Umango promotes is the lifestyle of shoplifting from multinational corporations. So that involves also, a trick fashion component. Sort of like the cross, a cross between fashion design and magic tricks. Because we have to wear clothes and make bags that make things disappear. In your multinational corporation supermarket. So that's one thing that we're also doing here. And also to that, we apply that whole no copyright kind of logic where people sort of teach each other and develop it between a lot of people. Was that clear?
I think so, yeah. It sounds really great. It's really inspiring. You know, I mean, I don't know. It's exciting. I mean, it sounds like a lot of work, but it sounds kind of ideal. Like, I don't know people working in those kinds of ways here, like in such big groups and sort of no authorship kind of thing.
Uh-huh. Well, it's not really exactly a no authorship. It's like, it's no property. I mean, it depends on, that's where it gets sort of complicated, but, I mean, you can make something and be proud of it, you know?
Yeah.
Then you sort of have to, again, the information has to be, you know, so go around and people can have to be able to use it. You don't own the information, the technology, the techniques, the ideas. You
right.
You can be proud of what you know, what you can do, and what you've done. But I don't know. It's complicated.
Well,
it's also an experiment. I mean, there's all, you know, you can, every person can just have a different attitude towards it too.
Right.
But I guess
that's also the exciting thing about it, too, to me, hearing you talk about it. Just like this idea of experimentation. Maybe that's more of what I feel like has energy. You know, it has this energy.
Yeah, that's the fun part of it. And also the part that's like, it's really hard to get to a situation where you have a sort of the space to experiment, because there's, you know, everything is working against you having the space to experiment.
Right.
Like, you know, even just the mental space to experiment.
Totally.
Because everything is pushing you to produce and to make use of what you produce and to experiment. You need to like be unproductive. You need to make mistakes and you need to do things bad and be a beginner and all this stuff, and there's like no, like hardly any room, you know, to do stuff poorly, to be a beginner, to, you know, to like to not be professional.
Right.
But
well, it
can
sounds,
I ask you questions?
Well, in just a minute, I just want to say that it just sounds really romantic from New York. So like, think about like, oh, you're in Barcelona, you know, making like it seems like, oh, maybe it's easier there, and I'm sure it's just the same as here, and attitudes are similar and the same, like, but there's always, like, at least in my head, this fantasy that it's better somewhere else, or...
Yeah, most people here probably think it's better in New York.
Yeah, well, I'm sure.
Can I ask you questions?
Sure.
Okay?
Sure.
Can you tell me a little bit, I mean, just things that maybe people here would be curious, especially like right now, about what's going on in New York. And
okay, I really hope I can do justice. It's in answering your questions. I feel like part of doing this is like I'm like calling from everybody information because I feel in a vacuum myself or unable to process what's thrown at me. But you can ask and I'll try to answer.
Yeah, just in terms of just in terms of like the people you're around, how do they feel about I don't know, the Republican National Convention and the upcoming elections and that sort of thing. What are people hoping for and what are people trying to do? And
I mean, what people are hoping for is really complicated, or it's like I think in some ways it's not really being spoken because like the only way to get the one thing that everybody seems to agree on, which is to get Bush out of office, is like that's kind of, and it seems like that's the one thing everybody agrees on. But then, you know, like it runs the gamut from like armed revolution, seriously, to vote Democrat, or just be a Democrat, you know. So it's.
Are a lot of people, do you feel more people are going to vote this election than
in some ways I feel like I'm in a little bubble. I mean, I think so. I do think so. Yes. I do think so. Like, stuff that's coming around, like, there's just so much publicity and just, like, you know, smaller groups of, I mean, smaller, like, abortion rights groups. And, like, it just seems like women as a group are very organized this time, and like younger women are really motivated, and of course, like the people that are in my small community, I feel like have always voted, and but it seems like it's going outside of that, and New York is electric right now. It's
like how.
There's just so much stuff. Like, every day I'm receiving emails about exhibitions of, you know, anti-Bush, to just be, like, as straightforward, but just, yeah, it's like, get him out of office. I mean, there's the huge march that's planned, and then there's tons of little marches, spin-offs of that. There are people I was just reading, before I called you a little while ago, this article that was in The Guardian about this group of people that's been walking from the Democratic Convention to the Republican Convention, sort of like making this walk performance of coming here. And I just there's all sorts of parties. It seems like every night there's some sort of fundraiser party, dance, disco, you know, organized by everyone from shopkeepers to, like, you know, gay S&M enthusiasts, you know.
Oh.
So it's...
That's cool, people are partying.
It's totally cool. I mean, I'm not partying because I'm not a kid right now, and we're doing this show, and but it's totally exciting, and I feel really... happy to be in the mix of it.
Say the day after the election and Bush loses and Kerry wins.
Uh-huh.
What do you think the people maybe around you or close to you, how would they, what were their sentiments be?
I mean it would be purely speculation. I think that my sentiments would be great, but I hope that, I mean, unfortunately, I think this momentum just can't sustain. I mean, it's in a frenzy right now, I feel. I mean, I don't know that everyone feels like that, but I mean, I guess because like Mark's curating the show and on doing this radio thing every day and then talking to people about it every day, so it feels a little bit frenzied in a good way. And I just can't imagine that that would sustain, but hopefully it would, because, you know, the there's a very fine line between the two. You know, it's not that all of a sudden everything's going to be better. Hopefully many things hopefully would be better, but
do you think it'll be, I don't know, because,
or easier, not
because when, I don't know, because I was in Israel when several years ago when they had elections, and Bibi Netanyahu was the prime minister, and he lost the elections, and Barack came, and there was this insane party in the middle of this, like, sort of supposedly spontaneous, I'm not even sure now that it was spontaneous, but everyone just, like, came out to the big square, and it was just, like, people were, like, euphoric, and I felt, I didn't feel so euphoric, you know?
Right.
I felt like relief was more of a more of an adequate thing to feel. You know, it's just like, yeah, he's gone, but I mean, I wasn't euphoric, because I was just, like, glad, like, the sort of Bibi Netanyahu nightmare is over, but, because he was really awful, but I didn't really think that, like, okay, now we've won, now things are going to get good or anything. I mean, I think it's, I don't know, just voting is not enough.
Well, that's where it's just so confusing, you know, of course. Voting is not enough, but it's like there need to be major changes. And I think most of the people, like, within, like, the arts community, at least, would agree on that. But once you get outside of that, like, you're talking about, like, radical, like, what does that mean, you know?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, yeah, there's, it can mean a lot of, things. It can mean a lot of things. It's just that, yeah, just the fact that you have a system where you can vote, then I don't think that already makes it a democracy. Mostly because most people don't even do it.
Right. Well, and then you hear from, you know, radical activists, like, oh, voting, it's just something they throw at us to, like, make us passive. You know, like, it's, like, what's your choice? Your choice is between Wonder Bread or the generic white bread, you know? It's not like there's really a choice involved, like, much of a choice, a distinctive choice.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's different filler.
True. Michael Moore in a book wrote, "Don't vote, it only encourages them."
Yeah.
and now he's all about, he's all trying to convince people to vote for Kerry.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just, you know, in some ways, it's I don't know if I'm saying this the way that I want to be saying, but, like, it's intriguing to think that if Bush does win, then what's going to happen? Like, okay, then, like, is that what it's going to take to, like, cause some major changes, or, like, what's going to push us into action for making changes for how we run our country and what we put upon other countries.
Yeah. That would be the most violent way.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's terrifying. It's totally terrifying. I mean, terrifying.
Yeah,
it is. It's terrifying. It's scary. And we're going to come live with you in Barcelona.
We're going to leave.
You see a spot for us in the squat. Well, I want to ask you the same thing, but I feel like I have to go because I also am supposed to talk. Well, I want to ask you, like, the same thing, I guess. what are people saying, like, from the outside looking in? You know, what, besides cynical, like, smart-ass commentary, like, what?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say, because, I mean, obviously I'm in a, and I'm actually in my own sort of bubble, too. I mean, you know, the people I'm around are activists and stuff like that, so, I mean, it's a very particular perspective, but I think, Spain was, the majority of people in Spain were straight out against the war in Iraq. So, I mean, everyone was, of course, really outraged when it happened. They were against it even, you know, like a month before it happened, there were, you know, demonstrations here and really, really huge ones. And, so people were just really, obviously really outraged. Because, you know, everyone I know obviously is really, really against Bush, but they're, like, with these people are people who are really, they are pretty much against voting, because they don't think that that's really what makes a democracy. I don't know if they would think that if they were living in the United States. Maybe they would, make an exception this election to, just to, you know, to do something that realistically would get Bush out of office. But yeah, I mean, that's the crowd that I'm around. I don't think there would be, I think it would be like I said, it would be a relief if Bush didn't win. It would be, they would feel extremely outraged if he did. I don't think they would ever get excited about Kerry in any way,
right,
or about the Democrats. People aren't even talking about the United States and the elections so much, you know? It's not, I mean, like, I'm sure it's in the newspapers and people follow it, like they follow the Olympics and...
Right.
but really, I mean, the people I'm around are a lot more interested in what's going on in Venezuela, are a lot more interested in what's going on in Israel and Palestine, in Argentina. I mean, but maybe because, I don't know, maybe because that's where sort of the, I don't know why. I don't know, but it's also, maybe it's because, you know, they're colonies, so they're Venezuela, Argentina, so
right.
Maybe they're, that's their, they have a language connection and an historical connection to these places. But yeah. The United States, yeah. I mean, yeah. Outrage. Possible relief if he loses.
Right.
That's what I can tell you. People laughed a lot when they heard that when John Kerry and, do you know that? That when John Kerry and Bush were campaigning in the same city, I don't remember where it was. They came to the same town the same day for some reason.
I did hear something about that.
And four banks were robbed.
Yes, yes.
So everyone found that really amusing.
Yeah. 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 Well, thanks so much. Maybe I'll call you again within the weekend.
Okay.
Ask you more about it too, because it's curious. It's good to hear you talk about it, because I think you're also engaged in a group of people who are thinking and talking about it, these things.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And also, we'll ask you about the work you guys did with Christoph, because he's in the show, too.
Right.
So.
Cool.
All right.
Okay.
So, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And take care, and I hope you get some delicious tomatoes.
You too.
All right. All right. Bye.
Thanks, Erica. Bye.
Bye, Luther.
All right, so that was Luther in Barcelona, and next we're going to talk to Mark Lepson, the curator of the Watch What We Say exhibition that this radio show is part of, and I'm passing him a microphone. Okay, you're in the wobbly end.
Hang on one second, I'm just going to go get my papers.
Okay, he's going to get his papers. So that was really interesting, talking to Luther in Barcelona and hearing about his project. And the group of people he's living and working with. It'd be interesting also to have people email if there are any questions for him. Ellen, I should get his links and put them up on the radio site too. So, Mark Lepson, the curator of Watch What We Say, thanks for joining me at RadioFreeErica.net.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here. And I have to say that you've been propelled to number 2 in the top 15 Mac streams on the Nicecast website, because I turned it on the other computer and was listening in, so there's 2 other people right now besides our computer who are listening.
3.
Well, you got 4 now?
Anyhow.
Anyway, sorry, but it's
so
great to be here.
And
I'm excited.
Listeners. So, Mark, I guess I just wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about both being a visual artist yourself and then, like, kind of being on, I guess, what it seems like from the visual artist side, the other side, doing the curating and sort of what you're learning in that process, and then also just sort of your process with the show, like how it came to happen, and then a little bit about your own projects too, so your own artworks. So whichever one of those you want to tackle first.
Most of you get the middle part.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, for everybody who doesn't know that the show is opening tonight.
I'm just checking levels on you while you talk.
That's fine. The show's opening tonight at Schroeder Romero, which is at 173A North 3rd Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, New York, from 6 to 9 p.m. And what do you want me to talk about first?
Whichever of those, I'm sorry, I'm looking at the levels here also, so.
You have to tell everybody that.
Okay, so whichever of those, Mark and I have a long history together.
A very close relationship.
A very close working relationship.
First of all, it's been exciting for me to do this project.
Talk about the project first.
It's been really exciting for me to do this project because it's something I've been thinking about for over a year, for a long time in one form or another. It started out when Dred Scott and I organized a show just after the start of the official part of the Iraq War, which was, I guess, last March. We did a show called Art During Wartime, where it was more of an open call, sort of a limited open call, where we sent out an email to artists who we thought were interesting, would be interested in participating in a group show of works, you know, talking about the war itself and the issues around it. And then we said to them to, you know, send this out to 5 people who you know, who you think also would be good for it. So in the end, there were, I think, between 50 and 60 artists who participated in that show that was down in Soho, and it was up for 1 week. And then sometime after that, we went to, there was an event at Lincoln Center called Poems Not Fit for the White House, which was sort of inspired by Sam Hamill, the poet who had been invited by Laura Bush to the White House and then turned down the invitation and sent in a manuscript of poems. I don't remember if they were his poems or poems. What he did was actually he put out an open call for people to submit to him poems that he would then give to Laura Bush at the White House, and he was subsequently disinvited that's what happened, actually. And so this poem's not fit for the White House was where they asked some very significant poets to read their own poetry and poems by other people, sort of, you know, all on the theme. And it was really inspiring to me as a visual artist, and so I wanted to do something not on that scale, but to organize a show of the idea being that, you know, people who are addressing political issues, but through more lyrical means, and they're not necessarily, you know, posters or directly propaganda or clear message artworks, although I still wanted to be messages that dealt really directly with these issues, but that somehow, you know, had several layers. So that was the original conception, and it sort of morphed into this show, which is sort of an in-between of the ideas of the original ideas for Watch What We Say and the Art During Wartime show, where there's now, I think, 20 artists who are participating, and it kind of runs a gamut from people who are dealing more abstractly with imagery taken from different iconography of popular social movements, to people who are doing really, really direct paintings, and in a really painterly way, dealing directly with political figures or images from the media and things like that. So it's a really good, it's a really exciting mix of people, I think. And we finished hanging the show last night, and I think it looks all really great together in the space. And so it's very exciting.
So how did you decide who was going to be represented in the show, or like, how did you find the work?
Well, some of the people were people who I knew already and whose work I was interested in, and those were kind of the core people. Some people who I knew, other people whose work I knew well, and I was able to get in touch with through one or two other people. So that was the original group, and then it was really I told those people and other people that I knew about this show and the artists who were already, you know, selected, and they suggested other people, and I talked to those people and asked if they knew others, and, you know, there were lots of artists, other artists that I would have loved to have included also, that for one reason or another, either people who I found out about their work too late, or their work was just kind of too big for the space, or, you know, it just they were not able to coordinate with me. So, I mean, it could have easily been 40 artists, you know, but this is a little bit slightly more digestible. And there are a couple of great shows up right now in New York as well, of more of salon shows. There's one that's at Deitch Projects that I don't know how many artists, but the list is huge. It looked like 40 or 50 artists, similar to the show that was at Ronald Feldman last year. And I think Ronald Feldman, they also have a show as well. There are a couple of really great poster shows that are up right now. One in Brooklyn at Stay Gold Gallery, which I think they're Stay Gold. .com maybe, and the other one is from the Peace Signs book, which came out earlier in the year, and that's a gallery called Chisholm Gallery in Chelsea. But so those things are happening. But so how did I say? So yeah, so that was kind of the process, combination of who I could actually get in touch with. Some artists were I had seen their work and contacted them. Others were recommended to me. I didn't know anything about their work, and then I found out about it and thought this would be great. So that's kind of how that evolved. So, and I guess the other part of the question was, how does it feel to be on the other side of the curator-artist relationship? And, I mean, for me, it's been really great, because the notion of the show, there's something, an aspect that's altruistic or, you know, very much focused, and all the people I've talked to have been, you know, since their work already relates to these issues, they've all been really enthusiastic about it and interested in participating. Even people who maybe didn't work out with for whatever reason, but they were still, you know, interested. So that's been really great. And I got to meet some artists who I didn't know and whose work I wasn't aware of, who turned out to be really, really excellent people. And also got to work with people who I already know that are excellent people, and got to give them an opportunity to do some new projects. You know, people who I said, hey, we're doing this show and I think this would be great. And, you know, they had to make a painting in a month or do a radio project or whatever it was that they had on the back burner. It was a good impetus. So I think it's been really satisfying in that way. I mean, the other thing is I've gotten to see a little bit closer hand just sort of the workings of galleries and how that, you know, there's a certain politics of that involved that I was aware of, but now I've had to actually negotiate it a little bit more, you know, galleries who feel they represent artists, but the artists don't necessarily feel that the galleries represent them, and, you know, sort of, and also artists who are actually represented by galleries, and, you know, negotiating, and again, and negotiating sounds like bargaining, but more like, you know, figuring out how that all works and understanding it, and and the Lisa and Sarah Jo at the gallery at Choi Romero have been really excellent in terms of, you know, taking care of things that can be taken care of from their end business wise, and, you know, giving me guidance with that, because it's been so, it's been really a collaboration, you know, in that way. So yeah, it's fun. It's fun going to other artists' studios to see what they're doing, and it was only maybe a little, like, not uncomfortable, but a little bit weird at the beginning, or like one or two of the studio business where, you know, I come into a room and somebody's got their stuff and they're kind of, you know, somebody who I didn't know before, and there's that dynamic of kind of critical, you know, whatever.
Right.
But it was overall really actually very relaxed. So.
Right. And so you talked in that a little bit, like what you've learned in the process, and like what's been surprising in it to you, and so how do you feel like these things relate to your visual art, and do you feel already their influence, or have you been feeling the show's influence because it's something that you've had that you've been thinking about for a while? Like, how do you think they've informed each other?
Well, I think definitely, like, my concerns as an artist are reflected in the selection of the works in the show. I was talking to one of the artists in the show, Peter Scott, and we were talking about exactly that thing, because he curated a show at Momenta last year around this anniversary of, and I don't know if you want to answer that or not, but
it might be someone with a question for you, so I'm just going to
okay, I'll keep talking. Am I still on?
You are still on, but so is the phone.
Just pull it out of there. Just pull it out of this. Okay, so, yeah, it's been really interesting, that idea of...
Hello?
That the show is kind of a reflection
of my own
aesthetic.
Hey, Lisa, hold on just a second. I'm going to put you on the radio. Mark is talking. You want to... Did you call to be on the radio, or did you call with a question? Okay, I'll have him call you when he's done talking about the show on the program. Okay, great.
That was just Lisa. Lisa Schroeder from the gallery was on the phone.
Yeah, that was Lisa.
But so anyway, we were talking about how the show becomes a reflection of your own interests as an artist, and it's in a way, in some conceptual grand way, you know, like every piece is some aspect of what I'd like to be doing, you know? Like things that you really connect with as an artist and say, hey, this thing is great, and there's something about it, whether it's the way it looks or the way it's put together or the concepts behind it, or, you know, that if I were able to be 20 different artists, you know, maybe these are the 20 different artists that I would like to be, and so their work reflects my sensibility, definitely. I mean, in terms of it affecting...
It's such a generous thing to say. It's like that's I don't know.
Well, I don't know that it's true. I mean, if I had to pick 20 artists that I could be, I don't know if it would really be. But I mean, but in some way, yeah. I mean.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful, like, vulnerable thing to say. That's all. I don't know. Anyway, maybe. Just wanted to.
But I mean, at the same time, I mean, in terms of it influencing my actual work as an artist, I mean, the major influence it's had is that, you know, I haven't made any art all summer because this has been my focus, which is fine. Like, I don't feel it's been a great creative endeavor, but.
Right.
You know, I mean, just the practicality of, you know, New York and work and family and all that, that's the reality of the situation, but...
Does it make you want to flip back and forth between curating and creating as well, or to continue that, or do you feel like this was like an urgent thing that you felt like you needed to organize and do, and now you're more in commentary to the times rather than in relation to...
Right. Well, I think a little bit of both. I mean, I think that, you know, I'm not eager to embark on a career as a curator, but, you know, I'm eager to get back to making artwork and have other people organize it and put them in shows. But I certainly, you know, the experience has been good, and through the show with Dread, and then I curated a web show for Visual Aids, And I mean, those have all been really good experiences. So I like doing it. And I mean, they've all been around sort of urgent issues, but I don't feel like it would be limited to that. You know, I enjoy doing it. I mean, the difficulties are all the practical things like space and time and money, you know, I mean, so, you know, the show's only been up for 1 week, 8 days, and a lot of people will see it, but a lot of people won't see it because it's short, even people who'd like to see it. So, it's, tricky.
Yeah. I was just talking with Luther in Barcelona about, like, how everything's set up against, it's set up against experimentation, and I'm not that, anyhow, I feel like these things fall within that, the time money aspect concept.
Right.
So I'm not exactly sure how to ask the questions in relation to like political agendas or, I mean, can you, talk a little bit, I mean, specifically, like, here's the Republican National Convention, this work's going up in relation to that, like, what can we hope for, what are, like, the intentions, those, like, what can we hope for within, like, the arts community in a show like this, or it going outside of the arts community, like, what?
Well, I think it's kind of two things, I mean, in terms of the political agenda of the show itself, and then the other part of it being how can this affect change, these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. I mean, to answer the second question, the second part first, I mean, I think that, I don't imagine that this, I don't know, pretending this show in itself is going to affect change, but I think as part of a larger movement of things that are happening at this particular moment, I think it's a really important thing to be doing, and I think that all those things coming together are affecting change. You know, I think there's so many things happening in the arts today. I was listening in the car to Brian Lehrer on NPR, and he had somebody from Newsweek magazine who she's got every day they're printing a list of protest events, you know, just different things that are happening, and like whether it's rallies or theater things or art things or, you know, and I mean, so there's such a like critical mass of things happening through the arts, a lot of it through the arts community, which I think is really important and really great because, you know, I mean, hopefully people are moved by it, and whether it's changing people's minds or not, I mean, I don't know, and I don't know that that's necessarily the point, but it's more about it's creating the space for, at the very least, creating the space for a dialogue out in public, out in the mainstream public, you know, that because enough things are happening at one time, you know,
right,
that the newspaper writes articles about it and it's on people's minds, and that's really important. So, I mean, in terms of the political agendas of the work in the show, if putting my curator voice on, I mean, I think it's really wide-ranging, and it wasn't curated around necessarily a particular agenda, but more of hoping to be more of like people approaching all of these issues from, you know, the actual president himself and his policies and personal tics or whatever, you know, through, you know, the greater, like the sort of greater social movements, through very specific events that happen and dissecting those, you know, whether it's relations of race in America. Some artists are dealing with that. Some artists are dealing with issues of labor and immigration in the United States, in Mexico. I mean, I can talk specifically about the artists. I don't know. Others are, you know, are painting, you know, creating paintings that are presented in a very sort of historical way, in very painterly context, their subject matter is not your standard painterly fare, which is quite nice. there's also some things that are happening sort of off-site. Carla Rapice is going to be doing a performance on, I believe, the 31st in Lower Manhattan. She's had 7 different people that are walking around with these shopping carts, and each shopping cart is sort of a different themed idea, some one where you can put something into it and take something out that somebody else has put in, or things that are more conceptual about historical ideas. There's also this radio show that's happening every day. There's also the people from Electronic Disturbance Theater who are sort of coordinating a virtual sit-in of the Republican National Convention website, which the URL is kind of long, but it's if you go to...
I have it here, www.thing.net/RDOM/N. I don't think that matters, like the capital N-O Bush start-HTML.
Yeah, I mean, an easier way to get to it is if you go to if you're at Radio Free Arca and you click to the Watch What We Say website, and then you go to the Electronic Disturbance Theater and it'll be there.
Right.
That's maybe easier than that whole mouthful. But they're doing, so they're what the virtual sit-in is there's a page where you go and it loads up 12 home versions of the homepage of the RNC, and it loads them continuously, one after another, and so that the more people that do it, the more traffic hits the website, and that if enough people do it that the servers can't handle it, then it eventually slows the servers down and will eventually sort of shut the servers down because of all the volume. And they've done these electronic sit-ins with other political and sort of cultural events, and some of them have been, you know, quite successful, so it's a pretty exciting project. So there's all kinds of things that are happening. People dealing with the Israel-Palestine issue. People, who else we got here? One of the artists looks at contemporary historical Arabic poetry and also presents that in sort of a different way. So there's a lot of things happening. Another artist looking at consumerism.
So, is there anything else you would like to say?
No, I hope to see all of our listeners at the opening tonight.
Yeah.
And for people who are listening to this in an archived version as well. But it's just an interesting time right now, especially here in New York. You can feel, at least within the media, it seems like there's a real gearing up of just not necessarily the tension level, but the volume. It's really being ratcheted up this week for just like all these different things, with sort of the terrorist threat being the underlying driving force, you know. But also, it seems to me a lot of the media and maybe the government as well sort of trying to refocus people on this protester anarchist angle, and not really kind of, you know,
right,
putting a lot of that attention there. We'll see. I mean, I think I'm not. My personal opinion is that I don't expect there to be major upheaval in on any of those fronts. I'm sure there'll be a lot of issues there, but
right,
hopefully not.
So, do you think this is something else I was talking with Luther about after the? After the election, right now it seems like New York is in high gear, but in terms of sustaining some sort of momentum, like that our choices are, do you see this momentum sustaining itself?
For some time at least, but I don't know how after the election for how long. I mean, I think it depends on what things continue to happen or not happen.
Right.
I imagine there's going to be a big lull because I think people are going to be a little burnt out.
Yeah.
And also, and besides people being burnt out, I'm sure the media will present sort of a backlash.
Right.
To all of this stuff, you know, once the climax has been reached.
Right.
So, you know, who knows? Yeah, I mean, like, it would be great. I don't know, it would be great for the overall situation to improve and there to be more of sort of a constructive dialogue and less of the need for active shouting here.
Right. Well, thanks so much.
All right. You're welcome. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, you too.
Coming all the way out here?
Yeah.
Very nice. You have a lovely green room out there, although it's orange.
Yeah, I see. You got a snack.
You can cook your own meal. It's very lovely.
Good. Lisa Schroeder would like you to contact her at the gallery.
Okay, I'm going to give her a call. Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. So that was Mark Lepson, the curator of the Watch What We Say exhibition, and he is going to be at the opening tonight from 6 to 9 p.m. So I think that I will try once again reaching California to see sort of a more straightforward, I talked to my grandmother about what's in the news with her. There's something funny going on with my phone. My grandmother is, so we'll see if she's in. There was some confusion with schedule. Hi, Mom?
Yes.
Hey, it's Erica, and you're on the radio.
Oh.
Is Grandma there?
She is.
Is she ready to talk on the phone?
I think so. Hang on just a minute.
Okay. So she's been registered a Democrat for as long as I know. I'll ask her actually. Well,
good morning.
Hey, Graham. Good morning. It's morning in sunny California.
Yes.
How you doing?
Oh, my back's bothering me.
Your back's bothering?
Yeah, well, there's nothing I can do about it.
Is it the everyday stuff or it's something new?
What?
The everyday stuff that's bothering you, or is it something new?
No, it's the same thing. Wouldn't give up and go away.
Yeah, I know. Me too.
How you doing?
I'm pretty good. You're on the radio right now. It's on the computer, though. It's not on, like, the FM radio. It's on the computer. And, I'm doing this radio show. It's running with Mark organized an exhibition of artwork that's up during the time of the Republican National Convention here, and it's a bunch of political artists sort of making commentary on Bush and other sort of political relations. And, well, I was just calling you because you watch more news than I think anybody I know, and I wanted to know what you've been seeing on the news these days.
What I think about what?
What you've been seeing on the news these days.
Well, it's not much of anything. It's it shows the Kerry is running and Bush is in there. Knocking him down.
He's in there talking now?
So, I'm a Democrat.
Yes.
So word go.
How long have you been registered a Democrat?
All my life.
All your life?
That's right.
All right, so I won't ask you who you're voting for then.
Kerry.
Okay, well, something funny is going on with the phone here.
I can't hear you.
Yeah, something funny is going on with the phone here.
Oh.
Is there anything else? I don't know, anything else you've been noticing going on in the news? Like what they're saying about Kerry or Bush?
No, not really. I mean, I don't pay that much attention to it. I just know I'm a Democrat and they're not changing me. No way. No way.
No way.
So, that's about it. What are you doing with this?
What am I doing with it? I'm broadcasting it on the radio.
You what?
I'm broadcasting it on the radio.
Oh, you're kidding.
I'm not kidding. I told you it's on the computer radio.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, I thought I announced I had briefed you about...
She told me you were going to call me over here.
Yeah.
And I didn't get here till late. And, after your mother played tennis, she came by and got me in. So we're getting ready to go somewhere else now. So it's a good thing you called.
Okay, well, I'm glad I caught you. I tried earlier, but you weren't there yet.
Yeah, right. I was down to my house.
Oh, yeah?
Uh-huh.
How are things there?
Yeah. Everything was
good.
Pretty good, yeah. And, then your mother come by and picked me up, and she came home and took a bath and getting ready to go out. She's going to go to a doctor this afternoon, and so I'm going to go with her and see what.
All right. Well, I hope you guys have a nice time.
We'll work on it.
Okay. And thanks for talking to me on the radio, Graham.
Yes.
And
I'll call
you guys soon, not on the radio.
Oh. Okay.
All right.
How's the baby?
The baby's great. He's outside with Carol right now. They're having a play date.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well,
okay.
Say hi to everybody.
I will.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. So that was my grandmother, and she's losing her memory. She likes to be asked questions still, as we all do. But she's having a hard time recalling, as like she can't talk about. She can't talk about the. She can't. I'm just getting told that my volume is messed up here. Okay, seems that the levels are a little bit better. All right, so I'm going to read a little bit more from the Arundhati Roy at the end, as we end here for today. Yeah, it's a little discombobulating to talk to my grandmother and her memory. She used to like to talk for a long time about what she was hearing on the news and what was right and what was wrong and what was mixed up and not. And anyhow. All right, so yesterday, this is from the essay called Come September that she originally presented as a lecture in Santa Fe, New Mexico. None of us need anniversaries to remind us of what we cannot forget, so it is no more than coincidence that I happen to be here on American soil in September, this month of dreadful anniversaries. Uppermost on everybody's mind, of course, particularly here in America, is the horror of what has come to be known as 9/11. 3,000 civilians lost their lives in that lethal terrorist strike. The grief is still deep, the rage still sharp. The tears have not dried. And a strange, deadly war is raging around the world. Yet each person who has lost a loved one surely knows secretly, deeply, that no war, no act of revenge, no daisy cutters dropping on someone else's loved ones or someone else's children will blunt the edges of their pain or bring their own loved ones back. War cannot avenge those who have died. War is only a brutal desecration of their memory. To fuel yet another war, this time against Iraq, by cynically manipulating people's grief, by packaging it for TV specials sponsored by corporations selling detergent or running shoes, is to cheapen and devalue grief, to drain it of meaning. What we are seeing now is a vulgar display of the business of grief, the commerce of grief, the pillaging of even the most private human feelings for political purpose. It is a terrible, violent thing for a state to do to its people. It is not a clever enough subject to speak from a public platform. But what I would really love to talk to you about is loss. Loss and losing. Grief, failure, brokenness, numbness, uncertainty, fear, the death of feeling, the death of dreaming, the absolute, relentless, endless, habitual unfairness of the world. What does loss mean to individuals? What does it mean to whole cultures, whole peoples who have learned to live with it as a constant companion? Since it is September 11th that we're talking about, perhaps it is in the fitness of things that we remember what that date means, not only to those who lost their loved ones in America last year, but to those in other parts of the world to whom that date has long held significance. This historical dredging is not offered as an accusation or a provocation, but just to share the grief of history, to thin the mist a little, to say to the citizens of America in the gentlest, most human way, welcome to the world. 29 years ago in Chile, on the 11th of September 1973, General Pinochet overthrew the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende in a CIA-backed coup. I don't see why we need to stand by and watch a country go communist due to the irresponsibility of its own people, said Henry Kissinger, Nobel Peace Laureate, then President Nixon's National Security Advisor. After the coup, President Allende was found dead inside the presidential palace. Whether he was killed or whether he killed himself, we'll never know. In the regime of terror that ensued, thousands of people were killed. Many more simply disappeared. Firing squads conducted public executions, concentration camps and torture chambers were opened across the country. The dead were buried in mine shafts and unmarked graves. For more than 16 years, the people of Chile lived in dread of the midnight knock, of routine disappearances, of sudden arrest and torture. In 2000, following the 1998 arrest of General Pinochet in Britain, thousands of secret documents were declassified by the U.S. government. They contain unequivocal evidence of the CIA's involvement in the coup, as well as the fact that the U.S. government had detailed information about the situation in Chile during General Pinochet's reign. Yet Kissinger assured the general of his support. In the United States, as you know, we are sympathetic with what you are trying to do, he said. We wish your government well. Those of us who have only ever known life in a democracy, however flawed, would find it hard to imagine what living in a dictatorship and enduring the absolute loss of freedom really means. It isn't just those whom Pinochet murdered, but the lives he stole from the living that must be accounted for, too. Sadly, Chile was not the only country in South America to be singled out for the U.S. government's attentions. Guatemala, Costa Rica, Ecuador, Brazil, Peru, the Dominican Republic, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Honduras, Panama, El Salvador, Peru, Mexico, and Colombia, they've all been the playground for covert and overt operations by the CIA. Hundreds of thousands of Latin Americans have been killed, tortured, or have simply disappeared under the despotic regimes and tin pot dictators, drug runners, and arms dealers that were propped up in their countries. Many of them learned their craft in the infamous U.S. government-funded School of Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, which has produced 60,000 graduates. If this were not humiliation enough, the people of South America have had to bear the cross of being branded as people who are incapable of democracy, as if coups and massacres are somehow encrypted in their genes. The list does not, of course, include countries in Africa or Asia that suffered U.S. military interventions, Somalia, Vietnam, Korea, Indonesia, Laos, and Cambodia. For how many Septembers, for decades together, have millions of Asian people been bombed, burned, and slaughtered? How many Septembers have gone by since August 1945, when hundreds of thousands of ordinary Japanese people were obliterated by the nuclear strikes in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? For how many Septembers have the thousands who had the misfortune of surviving those strikes endured the living hell that was visited on them, their unborn unborn children, their children's children, on the earth, the sky, the wind, the water, and all the creatures that swim and walk and crawl and fly. Not far from here in Albuquerque is the National Atomic Museum, where Fat Man and Little Boy, the affectionate nicknames for the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, were available as souvenir earrings. Funky young people wore them, a massacre dangling in each ear. But I'm straying from my theme. It is September that we're talking about, not August. September 11th has a tragic resonance in the Middle East, too. On the 11th of September 1922, ignoring Arab outrage, the British government proclaimed a mandate on Palestine, a follow-up to the 1917 Balfour Declaration, which Imperial Britain issued, with its army massed outside the gates of the city of Gaza. The Balfour Declaration promised European Zionists a national home for Jewish people. At the time, the empire on which the sun never set was free to snatch and bequeath national homes like the school bully distributes marbles. 2 years after the declaration, Lord Arthur James Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, said, "In Palestine, we do not propose even to go through the form of consulting the wishes of the present inhabitants of the country. Zionism, be it right or wrong, good or bad, is rooted in age-long tradition, in present needs and future hopes of far profounder imports than the desires and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who now inhabit that land." How carelessly imperial power decreed whose needs were profound and whose were not. How carelessly it vivisected ancient civilizations. Palestine and Kashmir are Imperial Britain's festering, blood-drenched gifts to the modern world. Both are fault lines in the ragging international conflicts of today. Raging international conflicts of today. In 1937, Winston Churchill said of the Palestinians, "I do not agree that the dog in a manger has a final right to the manger, even though he may have lain there for a very long time. I do not admit that right. I do not admit, for instance, that a great wrong has been done to the Red Indians of America or the black people of Australia. I do not admit that a wrong has been done to these people by the fact that a stronger race, a higher grade race, a more worldly wise race, to put it that way, has come in and taken their place." That set the trend for the Israeli state's attitude towards Palestinians. In 1969, Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir said Palestinians do not exist. Her successor, Prime Minister Levi Eshkol, said, "Where are Palestinians? When I came here to Palestine, there were 250,000 non-Jews, mainly Arabs and Bedouins. It was desert, more than underdeveloped, nothing." Prime Minister Menachem Begin called Palestinians two-legged beasts. Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir called them grasshoppers who could be crushed. This is the language of heads of state, not the words of ordinary people. In 1947, the UN formally partitioned Palestine and allotted 55% of Palestine's land to the Zionists. Within a year, they had captured more than 76%. On the 14th of May, 1948, the State of Israel was declared. Minutes after the declaration, the United States recognized Israel. The West Bank was annexed by Jordan. The Gaza Strip came under the military control of Egypt. Formerly Palestine ceased to exist except in the minds and hearts of the hundreds of thousands of Palestinian people who became refugees. In the summer of 1967, Israel occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Settlers were offered state subsidies and development aid to move into the occupied territories. Almost every day, more Palestinian families are forced off their lands and driven into refugee camps. Palestinians who continue to live in Israel do not have the same rights as Israelis and live as second-class citizens in their former homeland. Over the decades, there have been uprisings, wars, intifadas. Thousands have lost their lives. Accords and treaties have been signed, ceasefires declared and violated, but the bloodshed doesn't end. Palestine still remains illegally occupied. Its people live in inhuman conditions, in virtual Bantustans, where they are subjected to collective punishments and 24-hour curfews, where they are humiliated and brutalized on a daily basis. They never know when their homes will be demolished, when their children will be shot, when their precious trees will be cut, when their roads will be closed, when they will be allowed to walk down to the market to buy food and medicine, and when they will not. They live with no semblance of dignity, with not much hope in sight. They have no control over their lands, their security, their movement, their communication, their water supply. So when accords are signed and words like autonomy and even statehood are bandied about, it's always worth asking what sort of autonomy, what sort of state, what sort of rights will its citizens have? This essay is quite long, and I started it yesterday, and I think I'm going to end here today and continue at the closing of tomorrow's program. Again, it's an essay by Arundhati Roy called Come September. It's from her book, War Talk. Arundhati Roy is the author of the novel, The God of Small Things, and an eloquent essayist about many of the injustices going on around the world, and many of them perpetrated by the United States or in conjunction with the United States. And again, that was a lecture that she gave in Santa Fe 2 years ago. So I want to thank everyone who participated in today's program. Again, thank Diane and Xenia and Nelson for helping me get the levels all sound all straightened out before broadcasting. Again, to invite everyone to come to the Watch What We Say exhibition opening tonight at Schroeder Romero Gallery from 6 to 9 p.m. And I hope you'll join me again tomorrow. We'll be interviewing the artist James Tillman from the Watch What We Say exhibition. So that's it for today. And there's going to be a disconnect because I'm going to switch over to play from archived information. And unfortunately, the program I'm using, you have to stop broadcast to switch which source you're inputting into the software. So, peace, love, and thank you for being here.